Hey there, fictional friends, and welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. I'm Megan.
And I'm Shireen.
And we are still in the middle of our coverage of Mythology and Folklore Month over here at Fully Booked. And in the spirit of keeping that going, I guess we just wound up with like Greek mythology types of adaptations this month in general, just because we did when we were making our selections.
Well, because it's hard to find folklore-related movies.
Well, it would be your King Arthur stuff.
Wouldn't that be? I guess so. Yeah.
Think about it on the other side of things, like the more like, you know, like not ancient Greece, you can find other stuff for sure. Robin Hood, like that kind of thing.
Fair enough.
Yeah. You can find stuff. It's just, you know, some of those movies.
No, we didn't.
Honestly, some of those movies are also really bad. Have you guys ever seen Robin Hood with Kevin Costner?
Ooh.
Kevin Costner is like maybe English accent?
What kind of accent was it? We don't know.
It makes for a fun time, though. To be fair, it's pretty entertaining. Yeah. So, anyway, anybody who only knows him from, like, Yellowstone and stuff now, go watch that movie. Ooh, it's a different Kevin Costner, let me tell you. 90s Kevin Costner is a very different Kevin Costner than right now.
I mean, he was trying to make it, wasn't he?
Like, yeah, that's true, I guess. I don't know. It's hilarious. Anyway, and I believe that movie also has a very intense Alan Rickman as the Sheriff of Nottingham. But, like, whoa, it's a lot.
Yes, like, it's like, whoa, like, you're coming in over here and everyone else is over there.
Yeah,
like,
it's just two different sides of the spectrum. It's very strange. Anyway.
We digress.
This has nothing to do with it. We're not talking about Robin Hood this week. So today we are talking about, I believe, oh my God, when is this movie from? 2000, the year 2000. I feel like I don't know how to say the year 2000 anymore.
I know. It's 2000, like 2000 and zero.
And nothing.
2000 and nothing.
2000 and nothing. I don't know. Just 2000. So from the year 2000, sorry, is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
To get back to his wife and kids, Ulysses Everett McGill will do anything.
Hey, any boy, Smithies.
But he's about to get off on the wrong track.
Who elected you leader of this outfit?
Well, Pete, I figured it should be the one with the capacity for abstract thought.
Boys, you just stick with me.
Man, we're in a tight spot.
Believe me, I got a plan. And I can get my wife back and we can get out of here.
Okay, I'm with you fellas.
This is a movie from the Coen Brothers. Who are like a writing slash directing slash producing duo, two brothers, Joel and Ethan Coen, who are very well known in like the filmmaking industry. They have a lot of different kind of like genres of film, but they've got a lot of really famous stuff as well. They did Raising Arizona, Fargo, The Big Lebowski, No Country for Old Men. That's all them. So they did a lot of like the writing, directing, producing of those films. So they're very prolific and very well known.
Did they do Inglourious Bastards as well?
No, that was no,
it wasn't them.
No. Okay. Oh my God, people are gonna be shouting at me right now. Quentin Tarantino. Sorry.
Oh, was that Quentin? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I think people are going to be shouting at me more than, you know.
Well, that's fine. You'll get it more than I will. Okay. So, for those of you who aren't, again, are uninitiated, aren't aware, 2000 was 24 years ago, which I don't want to think about because we were alive. But.
Oh, it hurts.
Yeah. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is actually, it's a Coen Brothers movie, and yes, it's an original script and everything. However, the story is actually based on Homer's Odyssey, which is an epic Greek poem. Homer famously wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey. The Odyssey follows the story of Odysseus, who was like an ancient Greek mythological hero. He was the king of Ithaca, and post Trojan War, he needed to make his way back from Troy to Ithaca. It took him 10 years to get there, and along the way, he encountered all manner of different types of entities, gods,
creatures,
people that he interacted with and had all of these additional adventures with and things like that. And because it took him so long to get back, he was presumed dead back in Ithaca, and his wife, Penelope? Yeah. She was, her and her son had to like fight off a bunch of suitors basically because she was pretty much the queen of Ithaca. So of course everybody was trying to get up there. So they had to like fight that shit off basically. But it's, the Odyssey basically spans like that 10 year period between the end of the Trojan War and him being able to make it back home.
And this is, like, again, very, like, old writing, like, very old story. And so, you know, take this with a grain of salt, because there's a lot of movies, books, poems that have been based on the Odyssey. Because when you think about it, it's an epic poem about a man who is journeying back home after the end of the war to get back to his family.
Yeah.
So you want to take that, like, framework, and you can apply it to quite a few different things.
100%.
You know, over the years.
Yeah. So what O Brother, Where Art Thou does is that, or what the Coen brothers did with this movie is that they take, like, the overarching story of the Odyssey, and they put, like, your three main characters into it, and they have kind of, that's it, like, sort of a bit of a, like, a madcap adventure across the American South, mostly Mississippi, where these three characters are escaped convicts. They escape from prison. They're, like, on a chain gang, and they escape from prison and are trying to make their way across Mississippi in order to find this buried treasure, basically, which is, okay, so the movie stars George Clooney, and as the lead character, it was Ulysses Everett McGill, and of course, Ulysses also is the name that's used, because I believe that in the Roman version, Odysseus is called Ulysses. I think that's, like, the counter.
Yes, because there's always, like, a Greek and
there's
a Roman.
There's always a Greek and Roman version. Yeah. I believe that the Roman version is called Ulysses as opposed to Odysseus. Yeah. So, yeah. So, and there's a lot of, many of the characters in the film are, that's it, based on characters from the Odyssey and based on characters from Greek mythology. You have, like, a Zeus-type character and a Poseidon-type character, a Cyclops, sirens, things like that, all throughout the course of the movie. So the film actually currently has a score of 7.7 out of 10 on IMDb and 78% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
And I think it had, like, a decent amount of, like, nominations and stuff it when did. It came out. I remember it doing quite well. And I remember even when I was a kid, like, I enjoyed it. It's fun. It's set in during the Depression in the American South. It's set in 1937 in rural Mississippi. It's got a really great soundtrack, like, very, it does really have bluesy, that very, very, bluegrass, folk music. That's right, like, that's very much like at the sort of center of the stylization of the film and stuff too. And there's a lot of it that you can tell is really based around, like, the music. There's always, like, some sort of ambient banjo, something or other, basically, that's playing at any given time that adds a lot to the story itself. So,
well, also the characters are in, like, a bluegrass band. Like, I'm using like air quotes here,
but they're great and I love their songs. Really good. Yeah. It's really fun. So, okay, so the three major characters, obviously. So, Ulysses Everett McGill, they just call him Everett. Everett's your lead character, played by George Clooney, and he escapes from in prison with these other two men named Pete and Delmar, and the three of them make a plan to escape together because Everett has a story for them where basically he's, like, so prior to being, like, you know, that's it, like, the reason that he was locked up in the first place is because he knocked over a bank, like, robbed a bank, and then buried all of the money somewhere and wants to escape so that they can all go and get the money and split the profits, basically, like, you know, escape from prison and then take off kind of thing. And as we do learn throughout the course of things, Everett would also like to get back to his wife.
Right.
Who is in another part of Mississippi. So the three of them escape from their chain gang. They want to, and also, oh yes, okay, that's it. Sorry, just context. They are on a time crunch because there's the certain part of the, of Mississippi, like the small sort of very rural area of Mississippi where the treasure is buried, is going to be purposefully flooded soon.
Right.
Because they're trying to move all the houses and everything out of the area so they can, like, make room for newer things. And I think put up an electrical grid or something. There's, like, a conversation about that.
Wow. Happens. Imagine using that as your tactic to get people to leave
flooding
their home.
It. Did that happen? I would like someone to tell me. Was that a thing? Because, like, that's insane.
Awful.
I know. Yeah. It's crazy. And they're basically making a lake. Like, that's what they want to do. Is that they're like, this is a lake now. And you're like,
I'm sorry, what?
My house used to be here, but okay.
I live here.
Yeah.
Get out.
So they take off. Obviously, the authorities do start following them, of course, so they're constantly trying to evade them throughout the course of the film. You know, first they're able to, they try to jump on a train car, but of course one of them trips and they're all still attached by the ankles, so they get dragged out.
Yeah.
And then they wind up... jumping onto the like a hand car.
Yeah.
Like a hand, yeah, it's called a hand car.
A blind guy.
Yeah. That, you know, like that thing that people would use in the old time. He is, yeah. In the old timey railroads that looks like a seesaw almost, that you push up and down and that's what makes it go forward. That apparently is called a hand car. I learned things while I was looking at this.
Interesting.
I had no idea. So they jump on this. The blind man, I think, is based on a character from mythology named Tiberius, who's blind prophet.
Yeah, he's the blind prophet, and like he's always there. He was in Oedipus as well, I believe.
I think he's
like a guide.
Yes.
He's always a guide in these stories.
Yes, so I believe that he's meant to be Tiberius because he also tells them, like, you will find fortune, but it's not the fortune that you're seeking, and all that kind of stuff. He gives them, like, this very vague, very sort of cryptic message, and they're all like, okay.
Gotta love it when they put those in, like,
I know, it's fun.
Stories
it's
and fun. Stuff, because you just know everybody's going to misinterpret
it. You're like, foreshadowing, foreshadowing, here we go. So they make their way to Pete's cousin's house, where he is with his kid. They have, like, a, you know, dinner and stuff with him, and at first the cousin's like, yeah, whatever, sure, you can stay in the barn. But, of course, it turns out that he ratted them out to the police.
Right.
The police show up that night and try to light the barn on fire to smoke them out.
While they're in it. And George Clooney just keeps saying, like, what does he keep saying? Like, oh, we're in a bit of a situation. We're in a bit of a situation.
We are in a bit of a situation.
Yeah,
everything. It's very funny.
Like, this has, like, a distinct, I find that this movie has a distinct, like, Royal Tenenbaums feel about it.
It does a bit, yeah. Like, it's not a Wes Anderson movie, but you're like,
It's got, like, a tone, like, where it's, like, everything's, like,
the comedy is very deadpan and very dry, and it's very funny. And the Coen brothers do kind of do this in some of their other movies, too. Like, The Big Lebowski does have, like, a bit of a vibe like this as well. Especially, like, especially because you have these really great back and forth, like the three of them together play off of each other incredibly well.
Yeah.
And I especially love Delmar.
Oh, he's funny.
He's so cute. And he just like says, he's like the stupid one, obviously. Yeah. And he just like says things that you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
He's just like kind of dumb, but really nice.
Yeah.
So they're being pursued by a sheriff named Cooley, who is apparently supposed to be your equivalent to, like, Poseidon in the Odyssey.
Okay. Yeah, because Poseidon's chasing them.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so basically, so yeah, so Sheriff Cooley is like, the Poseidon-adjacent character.
Right.
And they manage to get out because the kid, the son, is like, my dad sucks and I'm running away. Oh, my God, their run-off thing there, their R-U-N-N-O-F-T.
Yeah, run-off.
That they keep saying, where they're like, I'm going to, like, my wife, like, you know, he's trying to say, like, she left, but he doesn't want the kid to hear him. So he's like, yeah, my wife, R-U-N-N-O-F-T. I'm like, oh, God. So
they do this throughout the movie, like they keep repeating things. Yeah. But later on, it's like bonafide.
Oh, the bonafide thing.
The bonafide thing.
The bonafide thing is funny too. Yeah. Yeah. So they do manage to escape, and they take off in the cousin's car. Along the way, they pick up they get to a crossroads, and they pick up a young musician named Tommy Johnson, who shares a name with a real blues musician from the 1920s and 30s named Tommy Johnson, who, from what I read, actually, he himself had crafted a persona in which he sold his soul to the devil in order to learn to play the guitar, you know?
This is a recurring story.
Yes, that's a really big thing, like a crossroads demon kind of thing, you know, and people selling their soul, especially like in like the blues community, like the older blues community, there was so much lore around that. So I believe that the actual musician himself, he had crafted himself a persona like this, which is why when they picked Tommy up, he was like, oh yeah, I came to the crossroads at midnight last night because I sold my soul to the devil so I could learn to play the guitar. And he did. Look at that.
Yeah, and he's very good at it.
Exactly. They obviously, they need cash, like, because they need to be able to, like, get gas and stuff like that, get food, all this sort of stuff. So Tommy brings up that apparently in this really tiny little parish, there's a local radio station where they'll pay you money to just come and, like, sing a song.
Oh, okay. This is how their career starts.
Yes. Oh, my God. And this is so great. It's so great from this to, like, the lack of realization that they have as to what's happening for them until the very end of the film. It's really funny. So
they're so focused on running that they're not paying attention.
And getting to this treasure and whatever. Yeah, that's it. They're not paying attention to anything else. So they go to this place, and the older man who runs the radio station is blind. And they have this weird conversation where he's like, are you guys black? And they're like, yeah. Yes. Except for our accompanist, who's the one person who is black in their group. Yeah. And then as soon as he's like, oh, we don't want any songs like that and stuff like that, and the other guy, and then he's just like, oh no, we're not actually, except for our accompanist. And they can't say accompanist.
Yeah.
And then they sing the song, which is sort of like the anthem for the movie, basically, called I'm a Man of Constant Sorrow, which is like, again, very bluegrassy kind of thing. Tommy plays the guitar because he can now, apparently.
Yeah.
Tommy plays the guitar and they sing the song. And it's like, it's good. It's very twangy and everything. If you don't like bluegrass music, you'll hate this movie. But if you're into it's really fun. Yeah. So, and they call themselves the Soggy Bottom Boys, which is the most absurd thing I've ever heard in my life.
But then they become famous and they don't realize
it. I know. It's so funny. Anyway, so they get paid, obviously. Great. Cool. They take off, and this is when they encounter Pappy Daniel, who is the
is this
governor.
John Goodman?
No. This is the other older guy who's the governor of Mississippi, or the current governor of Mississippi. He runs like a part-time radio show and stuff like that, like through that station and everything like that. He's supposed to be Zeus, by the way, per the Odyssey.
Oh, well, that would make sense.
Yeah. He's in charge of everything, right? So, yeah. They meet him and they're like, okay, yeah, sure, whatever. But of course, like, his character recurs. They do take off together originally, but Tommy winds up taking off because the cops have tracked them down to a certain place, and because their car has been discovered, so they're like, fuck. So they take off. Tommy has taken off on his own. Don't worry, he'll be back. And yep. they keep on, like, recurring. These characters, like, come back. It's really funny. Yeah. So they... They're on a very rural road, and they there's a car coming towards them very quickly that stops. They flag it down and they ask for a ride. Little do they know, they've just gotten into the car with Babyface Nelson, who is a very famous gangster.
Right.
From the, like, 1920s and 30s. He was part of John Dillinger's gang. Mm. He was a really, really big deal. And he is driving away from the police, like, the exact thing that they would like to avoid. Right. And he, like, you know, Everett has to start driving the car because he's, like, shooting at everyone. I was like, oh, my God. So they have to go through all of that. And then they go with him into a town, and he robs a bank. And they're just there with him. Like,
they're like, okay. Like, these three main characters are, like, astonishingly dumb.
I know, I love,
like,
them.
Like, the three of them.
They're,
like,
so,
I would say,
funny.
Pete is probably the one who has the most about him, and, like, that's
kind
saying
of,
a lot.
Kind of, yeah. Kind of, it's true.
Yeah.
And it's just, they all have, like, a different way of doing it. Everett thinks he's smarter than he is.
Yeah, he really isn't, though.
Pete is sort of maybe quietly the smartest of them, and Delmar is just, like, the happy-go-lucky one.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So they do that really briefly, but then they kind of split off from Babyface or George Nelson when he takes off. They are driving again. They're a rural world, like, through the woods, basically, and Pete's like, I hear something. Oh, yeah, I forgot the whole bit where they get saved. That's so funny. Before that, there's, like, this whole congregation of people in the woods
who
are, you know, that's just part of, like, a congregation of people who are being rebaptized, you know, because it's, like, washing away your sins, la, la, la. They dunk you in the lake really quickly kind of thing. So Pete and Delmar go and do that, and everyone thinks it's ridiculous and just kind of watches them do it. But it's, like, a cute little thing because now they're just there and they're like, all my sins have been washed away. I always love how that's such a justification for things, like, all that shit I did. And then they have to, like, re-explain to Delmar because he's like, yes, but I've been washed away of all my sins. And Everett's like, yes, but the law doesn't see it that way. Like, we've escaped from prison, you fucking idiot.
Yeah, but Delmar doesn't seem to understand this. He's like, but we should be good now, right?
Yeah, I know. He's like, we should be fine. What's the problem? Yeah. Anyway, as they're driving through the woods, Pete's like, stop the car! And he goes running off into the woods, and you're like, what the fuck is happening? And they get to, like a bend in the river, basically, where there isn't, like, too much water. And there are three... women who are, like, washing their clothes there. They're just there being hot.
Right.
Pretty much.
Right.
And what these women are supposed to be the equivalent of sirens. So, you know, they would lure men to their deaths in the water
by
and things like that by singing to them. And they are. They're singing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they kind of hypnotize them to an extent, and then they drug them with the, like, whiskey or whatever it is that they give them. What is this supposed to be? Sorry, corn whiskey.
Yeah.
They drug them. They all pass out. Everett and Delmar wake up, and all of Pete's clothes are lying there. And Delmar's like, oh, my God, they killed him. Oh, my God, they've done something. And, you know, meanwhile, Everett's like, hang on. He's like, Pete, where are you? Like, I don't understand what's happening. And then... And then Dalmar sees something moving in his clothes, which are, to be fair, perfectly laid out flat, which is really strange. And he's like, they left his heart, because he thinks it's kidding. But then a frog crawls out.
He's like, he turned it into a frog.
It's so funny. And he just has this whole moment where he's like, oh my God, they turned him into a toad. And then, so of course, they take him because they think it's Pete. And
well, Everett, I think Everett doesn't think it's Pete.
Not really.
But he's like, I'm not going to bother arguing with Dalmar.
I think he just wants to humor him. So he's like, yeah, okay, sure.
Yeah.
So they take him because they're like, they turned him into a toad, which are like, what? Anyway, so they do take the toad with them. They put him in a little shoebox because they think it's Pete. Well, Dalmar thinks it's Pete.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then they get to an actual town. They're out like getting lunch and stuff like that. I don't know. It looks like a hotel restaurant. It's weird. Anyway, and then John Goodman, is a one-eyed Bible salesman. I think he's supposed to be
air quotes.
Calls himself Big Dan. This was before John Goodman lost weight as well, so he was still, like, in that, like...
Well, he wasn't as big at this point, but he was, still... Yeah,
like he hadn't gone through like the weight loss transformation that he's had now, basically. Mm-hmm. Like if you see like the Roseanne reboot and stuff that they did, like he's lost a lot of weight.
Definitely.
So he invites them out for a picnic, pretty much. They go with him and he proceeds to, he's weird, like he's really fucking bizarre. By the way, Big Dan is supposed to be like the Cyclops.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure where he was fitting into this.
The Cyclops is what he's supposed to be. So
I got it.
He mugs them, and he smushes the toad, so they think that Pete is dead.
Yeah, Delmar's like, he killed Pete! it's so funny how this whole, like, Pete as a toad storyline goes.
Meanwhile, what we have actually seen, unfortunately, is that Pete, after having been, like, drugged and stuff like that, I think woke up in, like, a bit of a stupor and was apprehended by the police.
Yeah.
Like, I think he stumbled off naked or something. And Sheriff Cooley is trying to get him to tell them where Everett and Dalmar are going. He does kind of wind up telling them because they're like, we're gonna hang you. Like, we're gonna kill you right now. And he's like, okay.
I don't like them that much.
Well, that's it. And then, Everett and Dalmar are still like traveling, just kind of hopping on the back of truck beds and stuff like that. And Everett has this moment where they drive by a chain gang and he looks and sees Pete working on the chain gang, but he thinks he's going crazy.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, okay, I'm
seeing him everywhere now.
Yeah.
What I don't get is, how do they end up like in a movie theater with the prisoners? Like,
I think they were bringing them there as like a like an outing or whatever, the prisoners, I mean.
Yeah, okay.
I think so. And I think that's why they wind up seeing
prison was a lot nicer back then.
Yeah, seriously. anyway, so they finally get to Everett's hometown. And this is when we actually discover, he's not really only here for this whole treasure situation. He also wants to find his wife, Penny.
Yeah.
Played by Holly Hunter.
Yes.
Hey, look at that. Elastigirl.
Because he's found out that she's getting married.
Yes. They have 7 daughters.
Oh, my God.
7.
It is so funny, though, when he, like, finally meets up back with her.
Yes. And she's got another baby, and she's like, no, I didn't tell you about it.
Yeah.
And she keeps telling the girls that their dad was hit by a train.
And she continues to maintain this story, even when he's standing right there. She's like, no, that's not your daddy. Your daddy was hit by a train. And he's like, stop telling them I was hit by train, I'm right here.
It's so funny. So she he finds out that that's it. She's like, you haven't never done anything like good or anything to help out or whatever. I'm marrying this man named Vernon.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's got,
and he's like,
money.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
So of course he's like, you know, if I can get my shit together, maybe I can get my wife back, which is basically what he wants to do. Because I believe that while he was in prison, they did get divorced.
Yes.
Was my understanding.
Yes.
So
well, yeah, did they get divorced? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's why, like, they're getting remarried and stuff later. Yeah, so, anyway, that evening, after the whole, they realize that Pete is not dead, and he's, in fact, in prison again, they break him out.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
They really, like, skirt over the details of how they do that. They literally just, like, show up where he's sleeping, and they just break
him
out.
And they're like, hey, we did it once, we'll do it again, it's fine. That's it. And Pete basically tells them, he's like, yeah, so the women drugged me, and then I guess they had seen, like, the wanted poster, so they turned him into authorities. And he gave away, that's it. And then because they were pretty much torturing him, he told the police where the treasure is. Mm. And this is when Everett confesses that, in fact, there is no treasure. He never robbed a bank. He was, I believe, arrested for impersonating a police officer. is what he was incarcerated for, if I'm not mistaken. There is no treasure. He made it up to persuade them because he was chained directly to them on either side. So he found out that Penny was getting remarried, and he wanted to stop it, and he didn't have enough time for them, like, to wait, basically. And Pete is so pissed because he, at the time that they broke out, he only had 2 weeks of his sentence left.
And now he was going to be in prison until 1987.
Another 50 years. He's like, I won't get out until 1987. And I was like, oh my God, it's 1937 right now.
Yeah, tagged on 50 years. He's like, I'll be 83. Or when I get out, and the other guy's like, well, I guess they're going to tag on 50 years to me, and I'll only be 82. Oh, like, wow.
It's so good. So, anyway, they have a fight, obviously, over this. In the middle of all of this, again, because this is, like, nonstop sort of, like, madcap adventure, like, these weird things just keep happening one after another after another. Lo and behold, we're in the Deep South in 1937, so just... You know, I guess because this is what was going on, they accidentally stumble into a KKK meeting.
A very big one.
Oh my God, it's huge. And it's
like, with, like, you know, a lot of spectacle going on. Like, it's not
the fire and the singing and the everything. There's like a whole chorus going on.
Yeah, they really were giving it their all.
And of course, it turns out that one of the men at the top of this KKK organization is a man who's currently running against Pappy O'Daniel for governor. And you're like, ew. Gross. Yeah. Like, he seemed annoying and abrasive the first time that you saw him. You saw him, like, a little bit earlier on. But this is, like, I was like, oh, wow, okay, no, fuck this guy. Anyway, so they stumble onto this KKK, like, a rally, basically. And they see, my God, that these people have captured Tommy, and they're going to lynch him.
Like, and
whoa,
I know. Like, you're just like, what the fuck? And like, they keep stumbling into these, like, situations
that are very serious, and you're like, oh my God. Like, babyface running away from the cops, robbing banks and stuff, and now this, you're like, Jesus Christ. So, they disguise themselves as clan members. They, like, knock out a few of them. Disguise themselves as clan members because they're like, okay, well, we have to go get him. And go to rescue him. And he's, poor kid, he's, like, very melancholic about it. He's like, yeah, well, I didn't really want this to happen, but it looks like this is the way things are going now. I'm like, aw. God, that's horrible.
You deserve better.
For some reason, Big Dan, Cyclops, smells them. I mean, I'm sure they smell a little ripe, but, like, what the fuck?
Well, he's a Cyclops.
Because he turns around and he's like, and I'm like, oh, what are you doing? Anyway, he finds them and, like, you know, like, pulls their hoods off and stuff. And then, of course, this turns into, like, a whole big fight. Yeah, that's it. So, okay, yes, it's Homer Stokes is the man who's, like, in charge of this. I don't know, faction of the KKK? Fuck, I don't know, fuck them. Who cares how they run? Anyway.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
One of them's in red, the rest of them are in white, that's all.
Yeah, he's in charge, that's all we know. Whatever. So that's it. He is the person who's, like, running in the upcoming election, and you're like, ooh, okay, maybe that wouldn't have mattered to people in 1937 in the South, but, like, it should have. Anyway. Anyway, they do manage to, pull off an escape and actually get Tommy out of there, which is good. And then after this, there's a bit of a reconciliation, because Everett does kind of convince the guys, like, please help me get my wife back. Please. So they sneak into one of Homer Stokes, like a campaign gala of some kind or something, like a gathering that's happening at, like, the town hall. With, like, the worst, like, beard disguises you've ever seen in your life. Where you're like, wow, okay. They come in and they... So at first, they're just performing, like, another song like the other guys do, because Everett has a whole, like, back and forth with Penny, who's there with her fiancé and stuff. They have, like, a whole back and forth about it. But then what we've seen interspersed just every once in a while throughout the course of the film is that the song I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow that they sang way back, like, a few weeks prior has become this fucking massive radio hit, and people are looking for them. They're like, who are these Soggy Bottom Boys? We want to get them signed. We want to make a record. We want to do this. Like, who are these guys? And they've become insanely popular. So the Pete and Delmar sing the first few lines of the song, and everybody like erupts into cheers, and they're all like,
"What the what is going on?"
It's been so insane. Their entire journey has been so crazy that they haven't they have had no idea that they've become like an overnight sensation, and everyone is obsessed with them.
Right?
They sing the song, and everybody goes crazy. Homer shows up in the middle of all of this, and he's like, "These are the guys who fucked up my KKK meeting." God. Who anyway shows up and is just like, "How terrible are these?" And fully tells people, is fully like, "I'm part of a secret society," wink, wink, kind of thing. And you're like, "Ugh,
yeah,
gross."
Yeah.
And you know, of course, is there, and he's like, "Ew." He's like, "These guys interrupted the meeting where we were about to murder someone."
Yeah, and we're all cool with this.
And we're all like, "Yeah," and that's it. Like, why are you like letting them do this and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. Where meanwhile, the governor, Papio Daniel, has been smart enough to realize, of course, because they've started singing and everybody's gone fucking crazy for it.
Yeah.
And his like posse who are with him, like his son and like a couple of other people, I think, who work on his, in his cabinet with him or whatever the fuck. Anyway, they kind of start being like, you know, he's like, there, and he's like, "Oh my God, they love these guys."
Yeah.
And the son is just like, "Yeah, but Dad, they're integrated." 'Cause of course there's a black man in the band. Yeah. 1937. I know. I'm just saying, I shouldn't even say that. 2024, these things still happen. But anyway, it's just, it gives you the ick. But you know, then he's smart enough to look around and be like, "Okay, but no one seems to care. Like, everyone really likes this music. So you know what? I guess I like this music too, and that's fine."
Yeah.
'Cause he's a politician, but at least he's a smart one.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's not going to go and like arrest these people in front of everybody now.
So the other one has shown up and has freaked out in the middle of this, 'cause he's like, "These guys humiliated me, basically. Okay, arrest, like, they should be arrested. They're convicts, and you know, there's a black man there, so that should definitely not be happening. Blah 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 blah." But of course, the entire audience is like, "Fuck you.
Yeah,
we like this
do
music.
Do not take our music away.
That's it. Get the fuck out of here." I would like to make it clear that it's not because they're open to the idea of anything. It's just because they like the music.
Yeah, they just like the one song.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. But because of all of these ridiculous comments that he's making, and even I think with some people to a degree, when he reveals fully that he's part of the KKK, they're like, and then this whole group of people like runs him out of the town hall on a rail. Like, they pick him up on a rail and they run him out, which is, I think, very symbolic, but that's what it is supposed to be. And then they launch back into the song. Everybody's happy, and Papio Daniel uses this as an opportunity to be like, "Look at how terrible my opponent is. I'm pretty great. I really like these guys, and they're all gonna be part of my campaign.
Vote for me."
I know, and I love that he's just like, every time he does something, he's just like, "Ain't that right, boys?" And they're like, "Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
It is," because he's helping them, and he also pardons them.
Yeah, I mean, they're not that stupid.
No.
Also, they are criminals to begin with.
Exactly.
So we have to remember that.
Yeah. So he grants them like full pardons. And then Penny gets back together with Everett.
Mm.
And she's like, "Yeah, but I need my original wedding ring. Like, I need my ring." And it's in the cabin where the buried treasure is not, actually. But it's in that cabin. Because I think I left it in the roll top desk. And he's like,
"Yeah."
And she's like, Penny's kind of annoying because she's there. And she's like, "I'm gonna count to three," and he's like, "Count to three," and it's like a whole thing. But they go off to the four of them go off to get this ring from the fucking roll top desk. When they get there, the cops are there, unfortunately, because Sheriff Cooley Poseidon over there,
he hasn't forgiven them.
No, and he hasn't forgotten this, so he's fully tracked them down and fully intends to kill them, basically. And he doesn't care that they've received pardons. He's like, "I don't care. We're going to kill you right now."
Yeah, he's like, "You ran away from me in the first place." So
Everett stands there praying because there's nothing else that he can do at that point. And at that very moment, the flood comes through. Oh, that's right. So everything gets flooded. We don't know what happens to the cops at all, but the three of them, four of them, Tommy pops up right after, pop up in the water in what is now, I guess, going to be a lake.
Yeah.
Whatever. Ironically, Tommy pops up on the top of that fucking roll top desk from inside the cabin. They open it and he takes the ring out, brings it, you know, a little bit of time goes by, brings it back to town, gives it to Penny, and she's just like, "This isn't my ring." And he's like, He's like, you told me it was in the roll top desk, and this is the ring that was in the roll top desk. And she's like, no, I said I thought it was in the roll top desk. Maybe it was under the mattress, or maybe it was here. I don't remember. Or maybe it was in like the chiffon robe. Like, I don't remember.
Yeah, and her whole thing is like, how could you not remember that this is not my ring?
Like, which, like, to be fair, she's not incorrect, yeah. But also, good Lord. And then he's like, okay, well, why don't we just use this one, or I can get you a new one, or something like that. And she's like, no, I can't believe you're asking me that. And so the whole thing is ending with just them walking, bickering, pulling all bazillion of their children on like a little leash thing.
Well, if they're on a rope. They're on a rope.
It's tied to all their waists. Yeah. It's very funny. And then you see the older blind man there, the Tiberius character, who's just like pushing his little hand car like through the railroad. And then, you know,
that's it.
End scene. It's just, that's it. Like, look, like, it does have like a certain amount of commentary about the American South.
Yeah.
It does have that very much like Americana vibe because of the, like, the landscape and because of the music.
Mm. Yeah, and they had, like, they actually brought in, like, some famous singers
Allison Krauss does some of the music for this. Hang on a second. I'm going to double-check some of this.
Yeah, we looked it up. Like, they were quite famous.
That's it. I'm going to look some of this up because, a lot of them have, because most of the people, like, these actors aren't really singers, so most of them have, like, they're overdubbed for the song part of things. George Clooney's overdubbed by a man named Dan Tominski, John Turturro by a man named Harley Allen, Pat Enright.
But they're part of a bluegrass band.
They are. All three of them, I believe, are part of, like, they're very big in, like, the bluegrass and, like, country music community. The three sirens are overdubbed by Emmylou Harris, Allison Krauss, and Gillian Welch. They are massive.
Yeah.
Emmylou Harris is a huge star, and Allison Krauss I've heard since I was a kid.
I don't know if I, like, or maybe.
Yeah. I don't know. They're very, very famous. So I was like, wow, okay, Jesus.
Can tell, because the quality of the music in this is fantastic.
Really good.
I think that was part of what made this movie so popular at the time.
Probably, yeah. That's it, that people were really into it because they were like, wow, okay, and the music's really great and stuff. So it does have that American feel. And there's something about movies that are, that really showcase the American South that I think do that for people.
Yeah.
Because there's just something about it that does feel like you can't find this kind of vibe anywhere else in the world. Like, this is where it is, basically. So I think that probably has something to do with it. But yeah, it's interesting. It's like a really interesting kind of story in general. Like, it's a really interesting modern take on something that is so old.
So old.
But really shows you that an adventure epic can be turned into anything you want it to be turned into. Like, it does not matter.
Definitely. You know? And especially with this framework of, like, you know, like we said at the beginning, you know, he's been on a big journey and now he's on this whole way back home.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting take on the story. It was funny.
Yeah.
Took me a minute to get into the humor of the movie. I was like, what is going on here?
When you're not expecting, when you don't, if you go in blind, you're kind of like, what is this movie?
Yeah. I was like, what is going on? And after a while, I'm like, oh, okay. I think I see what's happening.
Yeah. That's it. Have you guys seen, like, this movie at all? I know it's been quite a while since it's come out, but I wonder to an extent, like, how popular it still is in sort of, like, the lexicon of film and how many people have seen it and remember it. So you can let us know about that over on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at FullyBookedCA. And you can also check out our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/book was way better. But until next week, guys, keep on reading.
Thanks, everyone.